Buenos días. I am Eduardo Dylan de Rostiere. And good morning. Well, it's going to be an interesting morning zine. On today's show, we're going to hear two special programs. We're going to first hear a two-part interview with Jonathan Calzo, an educator, author, and writer. And his most recent book is The Shame of the Nation, the Restoration of Apartheid School in America. And then at 10, we're going to hear a program about communication and men and women with Dr. Michael Kimmel. He's a sociologist and an author and a pro-feminist activist in gender issues. The program was recorded by, of course, Peter Toby. But first up, we're going to have this interview with Jonathan Calzo, and that was recorded by volunteer Will Seaman. Jonathan Calzo.
Hello, I'm William Seaman, and this is a special KABU Public Affairs feature with a very special guest, Jonathan Calzo. Jonathan Calzo is a National Book Award-winning author whose works include Death at an Early Age, Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, and his latest, just out from Crown Publishers, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. Our guest has been working with children in inner-city schools for over four decades, and his work, his research, his books, and his articles and his lectures have inspired generations of teachers and parents alike in the struggle to provide children, all children, with education, with teachers and schools that they surely deserve. Jonathan Calzo, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back with your audience again.
Well, let's begin with this latest book, and I have to say that I was introduced to this book through the Harper's Magazine article. September's Harper's has an excerpt from this book. This title is really an indictment, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. You write that this book is not intended to make people comfortable, and I can say from what I've read so far, that's quite an understatement. Perhaps you could start with maybe an overview of the news that you're bringing us from the schools of our inner cities today.
Well, the grim news is that segregation of school children is back with a vengeance. The fact is that after the Brown decision, back in the 1950s, for about three decades, there was spectacular success made in the United States in integrating our public schools right through the late 1980s. And it was a success in all ways because it didn't simply help to break down the tremendous racial divide so that kids could actually know each other across racial lines. But during those years when Brown was seriously enforced, the race gap, that is the gap in school achievement between blacks and Latinos on the one hand and whites on the other, narrowed tremendously and continuously. Since 1990, the United States Supreme Court has dismantled almost all the enforcement instruments of Brown. And during these years, school resegregation has taken place throughout the nation at a very rapid rate, so that now, today, in 2005, I'll just stick to black children. The proportion of black students who go to segregated schools is at the same level as in 1968 when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And I don't just dish out statistics in this book. There are plenty of statistics. But I go to these schools. You know, I visit them. In New York State, for example, 7 out of every 8 black children goes to a segregated school. And I walk into these schools in New York, in Chicago, in St. Louis, in Seattle, and in Los Angeles, straight across the country, especially in the big eastern cities. I never see white children. I'm in a school sometimes with, you know, if it's a high school, maybe 2,000 kids, and there might be 6 white children in the school. And especially when I'm in the elementary schools, I used to teach fourth grade, and I spend a lot of my time visiting elementary schools now. Especially when I'm in the elementary schools, I look into the faces of the children, and I look right into their eyes. And sometimes I see the children looking into my eyes, too, because children search the eyes of grown-ups when we visit. And, you know, I look around the room, and if you took a photograph of the room, it would look, if you took a photograph of the faces of the children, it would look exactly like a photograph from a school in Mississippi in 1945. I look at this panorama and this total segregation, and I try to tell myself that this postmodern and millennial apartheid is what Dr. King and all our other civil rights martyrs died for. Because I'm old enough to remember that era. I became a teacher in the 1960s.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that history, because I know many of our listeners, you know, really have become politically aware in the last couple of decades and very likely grew up at a time, certainly when the perception, especially, of course, in the white community, in the more affluent communities here in Portland, for example, I think overwhelmingly, really felt that these issues of segregation were an issue of the past. So how did you first become involved in this? And your career really spans four decades. You mentioned Brown as a starting point.
Brown versus Board of Ed, which was 1954. But first of all, I just have to say bluntly, it's just amazing to me that kids who grew up in lily white suburban schools could actually think that segregation is a thing of the past. All they have to do is look around their room to realize that that's not true. But in any case, to go back very briefly in history, in 1964, three young civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. These were two young white men and one young black man who had volunteered to go into Mississippi in order to lead a battalion of hundreds of others who came later to try to break the back of apartheid in that state. And they disappeared one night in 1964, and it turned out they'd been murdered by the Ku Klux Klan. Until that moment, I had planned to become an English professor. That's what I wanted to do with my career. I'd gone to Harvard College, and I planned to go back to the graduate school at Harvard, and would have been really happy teaching literature the rest of my life. But that event, those murders in Mississippi, changed my life forever. And one day I simply got in my car in Harvard Square, and I drove over to the black community of Boston. And I walked into a black church, and I just said to the minister, "Can I be of any help? Can I be of any use?" And he said, "Yes, you can be of use, young man. In fact, I'm glad you came here to your own hometown instead of thinking you had to go to Mississippi, because as you're going to discover, all the racism in America isn't 2,000 miles away in the Deep South." And from that experience, I decided to become a teacher. I taught, first time I ever taught, I taught fourth grade children in a segregated school in Boston. I taught in the public schools for 3.5 years in all. First in inner city Boston in a segregated school, and then in one of the best white suburban schools outside of Boston, which had started an integration program with the city. It was one of 30 suburbs outside of Boston, the best suburban school systems, that formed a partnership with Boston so that thousands of inner-city kids could go to some of the best schools in America, very well-funded schools. So, you know, my first year, I was teaching in the worst, most poorly funded segregated schools in the nation, and then suddenly I had the chance to travel out to one of the best suburbs in America with some of the same children and see them in an integrated setting and see them in a school where children get all the luxuries and all the necessities that were missing in the city, including the very best paid, most experienced teachers and small class size and a beautiful building. That changed my life forever. And ever since then, I have, in one way or another, been working with black and Latino children all over the country. Now, as I say, there was great optimism up until the late 1980s as our schools became less and less segregated. And black kids performed better and better in these integrated schools because they were in schools which had all the resources that were missing in the ghetto. Since 1990, there's been this terrible backswing. At the present moment, in the typical inner-city school in New York or Chicago, schools I visit, 99.8% of the children are black or black or Latino. And, you know, I'm not too good in math, but 99.8% means that 0.2 percentage point now mark the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South of 50 years ago and socially and economically enforced apartheid in these northern cities now. And it's, for me, just heartbreaking, not only to see this in front of my eyes, but to realize that the nation is afraid to face this fact. The nation will not talk about it. The newspapers in these cities, when they describe a segregated school, they won't ever say it's segregated. They have all these semantic somersaults they use in order to avoid saying the real thing. So typically, if there's a school where, you know, 2,000 kids are black or Latino, and there might be 10 whites and maybe 15 Asians in the school, the newspaper says, this is a school with a diverse population. And diverse means absolutely nothing anymore. In fact, diverse has come to be a euphemism. It means, it says, diverse is a soft euphemism for segregated. Or sometimes reporters will say, a diverse school with many minorities. When all the kids are black and Latino in the school, I think the nation is embarrassed to have ripped apart the legacy of Dr. King, to have ripped apart the legacy of Brown versus Board of Ed. And so they have to find any way to avoid stating reality in terms that will trouble the conscience of newspaper readers. What most of our inner-city schools are doing now is trying to create good segregated schools. And they're very, very busy convincing us that it's possible to have perfectible apartheid. So, you know, essentially what our inner-city schools are doing, certainly in the real big cities like with large black and Latino populations like Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, what they're doing basically is Plessy versus Ferguson. Plessy versus Ferguson was the 1896 law that said it was okay to have segregated schools as long as they were equal. Separate but equal. That's what Plessy was. But these schools aren't even equal. These schools are separate and flagrantly unequal. And the inequalities are obvious. You know, anywhere you go, nationwide across the country, I mean, I can see this in front of my eyes wherever I go. I visited 60 schools in order to write this book, but the statistics are obvious and stunning. Nationally, on average, an overwhelmingly black school in America gets $25,000 less for every classroom than a school that's overwhelmingly white.
As a part of this book, you include an appendix that has these really stunning numbers showing the per-pupil funding for these schools in the suburbs.
Yeah, and I'll give you a simple example in New York, for example. New York City, you know, which is an overwhelmingly minority school system, and where 83% of the kids live in poverty, spends about $11,600 per child. You go out to the really wealthy white suburbs of New York, and they're spending $20,000 to $22,000 for every child. And these are suburbs in which maybe only 1 or 2 or 3 or 4% of the children are poor. So the kids in the inner city, you know, they're getting about half as much put into their education every year as the children of the privileged. Now, you know, there's quite a lot of irony in this, because a lot of religious people in America, and there are a lot of good religious people, believe devoutly that all children are of equal value in the eyes of God. In fact, every religion teaches that. All our children are of equal value in the eyes of God. And I'm sure in the eyes of God they are, but not in the eyes of America. In the eyes of America, these kids come into our public schools with a price tag printed on their forehead. The little ones that I know, the ones I work with in the South Bronx, in New York, or the poorest part of New York, you know, they're cheap babies. They're $11,000 babies. You want to see a $22,000 baby, you have to go out to the suburbs. Now, President Bush says money's not the issue. He insists that you can't buy your way to better education. He says testing is the answer. But, you know, whenever I hear people talk the way President Bush does, they say, money's not the issue. You can't buy your way to a better schooling. I always ask where they went to school. Most of the people, wealthy people I know who talk that way, you know, I still have wealthy friends, like people who were in my class at Harvard College. A lot of them live in New York. And they're very sensible and logical on almost every other issue. But on this one, they always have me to dinner at their homes, and I don't know why, because I know I make them uncomfortable, but they invite me anyway. And somewhere near the end of dinner, as we're having coffee, they'll look at me and they'll say, well, of course, Jonathan, it's not perfectly fair the way it is, but can you really buy your way to better education for poor children? And typically, the person who asks me that question doesn't even settle for the best suburban school. He sends his kids, when they're teenagers, he sends them to New England prep schools, to the expensive prep schools here in New England where I live. I'm sure people in Seattle have heard of them, like Andover, Exeter, Groton. President Bush went to Andover. You know what it now costs to go to Andover? It costs $30,000 a year. Some of these rich friends of mine have two kids whom they send away to these exclusive prep schools, so they're spending $60,000 a year to guarantee their children the royal road to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton. And they have the nerve to look me in the eyes and ask me, can you really buy your way to better education? And when President Bush talks this way, it just makes me sick at heart, because he knows what money buys, because he got it. His father bought it for him. And until we change this, we're never going to have an authentic meritocracy in America where people earn their eminence and power and wealth in our society by their own merit. It will never be possible. We will the best we're going to have is what we have right now, which is a hereditary meritocracy. If your daddy's got the money or your mom's got the money to send you an exclusive prep school or to buy a home in a spectacular suburb, you're going to be guaranteed the kind of wealth and power your parents have. And if you're born in inner city Chicago or South Central LA or the South Bronx, you're going to end up, if you're lucky at the most, you'll end up working for the people in the suburbs. I think this is outrageous. I just want to say one other thing. There are some people, including some black separatists, who think that it's possible to have a segregated school that's equal to the schools in the suburbs. And it's interesting, the white press loves to quote black separatists. I never see white integrationists like myself on programs like Fox TV, but they love to find these bombastic black separatists who say, oh, no, we don't need to go to your school. Don't worry, brother, we won't spoil any gun parties in Magnolia or Queen Anne. I've been to those sections of the Seattle, which is a very wealthy area. I don't know if you've ever been to Seattle and seen those sections.
Sure.
Or, let's say, Beverly Hills or any other wealthy suburb. The white press loves to quote black separatists who say, don't worry, brother, we don't want to send our kids out to your schools. We won't spoil life in your lily white suburbs. Just give us a little extra money so that we can have a better library in our segregated school. And we'll give these kids more tests, and we'll make them wear uniforms, and we'll be happy over here. This is a shameful lie. Anybody who's read American history knows very well segregated schools have never been equal to schools that serve the mainstream of America. They never were in the last century. They never will be in the next century. Segregated education is the oldest failed experiment in U.S. social history. And only truly ignorant people who have never read history could possibly indulge this fantasy.
I want to tell our listeners that they are listening to a special public affairs program with our guest, Jonathan Kozol, author of The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. And you're tuned to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and 100.7 FM in the Willamette Valley. I'm William Seaman, your host, and our guest, Jonathan Kozol, is going to be in town later this month on September 30th and October 1st, so keep an eye out for details. I think, Jonathan, you have location for that September 30th program.
Yes, I know where it's going to be. It's in a church at the corner of 12th and Taylor Street in downtown Portland. I was told it's called First Baptist.
We'll confirm the name and
the address. The event is sponsored by my favorite bookstore in America, Powell's. It's a wonderful bookstore. But it's not going to be at Powell's. It's going to be at the church. And it's being co-sponsored by a terrific group of teachers in Portland who are part of a national group called Rethinking Schools. They publish a magazine called Rethinking Schools. It's probably the best magazine for teachers in America, and they're co-sponsoring it. So we're going to have lots of teachers there and just good folks of all backgrounds. Even Republicans will be admitted.
even Republicans.
And they will be treated politely. But this isn't just going to be a book signing to sell books. This is going to be a political rally to rally the spirits of good people in Portland who understand history and are shamed at a president and Congress and governors all over the nation who have turned their back on everything that Dr. King died for. And I just want to say one thing quickly. Every school system that serves big inner cities in America naturally likes to claim that it's making progress. And, you know, I understand why. They have to do something to keep their spirits up. So every so often, they will say, oh, good news, reading scores for fourth grade minority children rose this year by 3 percentage points. And the newspapers always herald this as good news. And then what happens is, you know, 3 years later, bad news. Turns out there was a mistake. The scores are down again. Or more typically what happens is they do boost the scores in one particular year by forcing the teachers to drill children constantly for exams. And if all you do is drill kids for tests, which by the way they don't do in good suburban schools, this is being done in in desperate inner-city schools because the principals are so frightened of humiliation. So they drill the kids mercilessly for exams, and if that's all you do, it is possible to pump the test scores a few points. But these are testing gains. They're not learning gains. If they were learning gains, they would last. You would see the result a few years later. That doesn't happen. You take these kids who are being drilled to death, and now it's worse because of NCLB, that's President Bush's testing bill. It's even worse now. They have to do this every single year starting in third grade. You know, if that's all you do, sure, the test scores go up a little bit, but it doesn't persist because you take the same kids whose scores were pumped a few points in fourth grade, and you visit them in eighth grade, and you find they can't write a cogent sentence, and they can't read a social studies book. And by the time they get to 12th grade, nationally, the gap is just horrendous. This is a case where I did do research, and I'll give you the exact numbers because they're devastating, and every American ought to listen to these numbers. The typical black or Latino student in the 12th grade in America reads and writes at the level of the typical white child in 7th grade. It's a 5-year gap. So, I mean, this is just staggering. Those aren't just bad statistics. Those are plague statistics.
We're at the end of our half-hour segment, but we will continue this conversation. Please stay tuned for the broadcast date and time for the continuation of this program with our guest, Jonathan Kozol. And until then, I'm William Seaman, and this has been a special KBOO Public Affairs feature with the award-winning author and public education advocate, Jonathan Kozol. Thank you for listening. Hello, I'm William Seaman. Welcome to the second half of a special KBOO Public Affairs feature with our guest, Jonathan Kozol. Jonathan Kozol is a National Book Award-winning author whose works include Death at an Early Age, Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, and his latest, just out from Crown Publishers, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. Our guest has been working with children in inner-city schools for over 4 decades, and his work, his research, his books, and his articles, and his lectures have inspired generations of teachers and parents alike in the struggle for education reform, most specifically for equality of education for all children. We rejoin our conversation with Jonathan Kozol as he's commenting on the Bush administration's emphasis on testing as a strategy of education reform.
So when our school systems boast they improved the scores slightly in fourth grade by testing the kids to death, these really are statistical lies because they're not real gains. And in order to do this, by the way, they have to exclude everything that's not going to be on the test. So most of these kids, poor black and Latino kids, get no art, no music, no history, no geography, because those things aren't tested by the federal government. Those things aren't required. All that matters are the reading and math scores. You know, I meet kids in New York who have been to these segregated drill academies, and they don't know any geography or history at all. I discovered this once a couple of years ago when I was talking to some very bright sixth graders that I knew, and they'd been to one of these schools where they were just drilled constantly for their tests. And they knew I lived in Massachusetts because these kids knew me well. And suddenly one of them asked me, is Massachusetts in New York? So I said, no, Massachusetts is a different state from New York. And this was a black girl. She looked confused when I said a different state. So, you know, I got kind of scared. And I didn't want to embarrass her, but I did a little lesson. I tried to do a little lesson with them on states and cities and countries. And they looked even more confused. Now, these weren't babies. These were kids who were 12, 13, 13, 14 years old. I said, what country do we live in? I was almost afraid to ask, but half the kids in the group said, we live in the South Bronx. That's our country. The others said, we live in New York. They said New York was their country. So these are kids, and these are kids who passed the tests. See, they passed their required tests, and some principal probably boasted that she'd improved their scores, and the black and Latino kids were closing the test gap with white kids. But in reality, the cultural gap, the learning gap, was larger than it had ever been. Here were intelligent kids on the verge of their teenage years who didn't know what country they lived in. And, you know, President Bush still insists that this sociopathological agenda of his, of testing the kids and testing the kids, don't spend more on them because, as he says, money doesn't matter, class size doesn't matter, teacher salary doesn't matter, just test them. He says it's working. He keeps repeating that. He says, it's working. We're making progress. But this is a lie. We're not making progress. And it's a deadly lie because once you steal the years of childhood from children, you can't ever give those years back again. It's the worst possible crime. Someone steals your car, there's a chance the police can find it and you get it back. But nobody can give you back the eighth year of your life. Once that's gone,
Jonathan, I know your latest book has
an angry book.
It's an angry book, but it's a very moving book. And in particular, you know, I think in the back of your mind right now, you may be thinking of these young students. This one young student, I think her name was Pineapple.
Oh, I love her.
Could you talk about the role she plays in this latest book?
Pineapple is one of those little kids in the inner city who just capture your heart from the minute you meet her. I met Pineapple years ago when she was in kindergarten, and I've known her ever since. And I followed her career through one of the very worst segregated schools in New York City, in the Bronx, in the South Bronx. This is a school which had very high turnover of teachers, which is common in inner city schools, where we tend to send our least experienced teachers. The most experienced teachers typically end up in these schools that serve wealthier white people, even within the same city. And because our teachers were so inexperienced, a lot of them kept quitting because they didn't know how to handle children. So one year she had four different teachers in a row, and the next year she had three different teachers in a row, learned almost nothing, even though her school had this test drill curriculum. The particular name of this test drill system they were using is, ironically, is Success for All. And it's one of these relentless phonics programs. And I'm not opposed to phonics, by the way, if phonics are used intelligently and if they're combined with reading comprehension. So, I mean, the best way to learn phonics is while you're also reading good books, I mean, good children's books. But in this school, there were no good children's books. They didn't do that. Instead, the teachers were handed a script, a literal script to read, which told them the questions questions they must ask, and the answers the children must give. And, you know, Pineapple loved to tell good stories. So she raised her hand to tell the teacher something interesting or something sad, maybe, that happened to her on the weekend. The teacher had to cut her off because the teacher had to stick to the script. By the way, that's a tragedy because in good suburban schools, when a child raises her hand and has a beautiful story to tell, the teacher doesn't need to cut her off because the atmosphere is relaxed and the teacher can let that child tell her story. And sometimes at the end of those wonderful rambling stories that little kids tell with lots of ands and buts, children are like artists. They're like great artists of the run-on sentence. They keep saying, and then, but, this happened. If the teacher listens long enough, sometimes at the end of all those ands and buts, there's a piece of hidden treasure. There's something really beautiful. And the teacher, who's patient enough to listen, uses that little piece of hidden treasure at the end. It might be an explosion of deep emotion on the child's part. as a key to unlock that child's motivation to find out what she really longs for in life, what makes her happy, what she fears. And then she says, okay, now we've got something to write about. But in these drill academies, the teacher isn't allowed to do that. So Pineapple went to that kind of school. She was miserable there. She never talked about race to me until one day, finally, when I was visiting her, because she knows something about my life. I mean, she questioned me all the time about my life. In fact, she knew almost everything about my life because she's so good at some wonderful little kids are so good at manipulating you. They do it so charmingly that you don't even mind. So she had some sense of the privileged life that I lead, that I went to Harvard College and that my father was a doctor and so forth. One day she looked at me and she said, Jonathan, what's it like over there? So I said, what do you mean by over there? Do you mean in Massachusetts, in Boston? You know, she knew I lived somewhere near Boston because I'm a Red Sox fan and she was a Yankees fan, you know, so we used to joke about baseball rivalry. She said, no, I don't mean Boston. I mean, and then she got awkward and she said, I mean, you know, over there where you live. And I said, no, I don't know what you mean. And she said, you know, over there where the other people live. And then I realized she meant where white people lived, but she was too polite to ask. It was as though she were speaking of another world on the other side of a wall. And that really is what it's like. And, you know, there are a lot of good people on the other side of that wall, white, decent, compassionate people. I think most Americans are decent people at heart. I think the people are far more decent, fair-minded than the politicians. I don't know how we end up with such selfish politicians when there's so many decent human beings in this country. And most of them, if they ever met Pineapple, they'd fall in love with her immediately. And, you know, if they're rich people, they would say, tell me what I can do for this little girl. I wish that I could do something for her. The trouble is that because of the segregation of our society, most white people never meet Pineapple. Or they eat one pineapple. But they never meet the millions of children on the other side of that wall. And so there's nothing to prick their conscience. In this respect, segregation, and particularly residential segregation, does a great service to the conscience of the privileged. Because what it does is it protects their conscience from the unselfish things that they could do and would do if poor children weren't locked out of their sight for their entire lives. Now, I'll just give one other quick example because I love the kids I meet, and I don't care what any racist politicians say. There are just as many smart kids in these inner city schools as any wealthy white suburb. At least they're just as smart before we ruin them, before we crush them by the unequal schooling we give them. In Los Angeles, I got to know a remarkable young lady, a Latino girl named Mariah. She was in 10th grade. This was in a high school, believe it or not, that had 5,000 students. It was one of the ugliest, most squalid buildings I've ever been in. No congressman or president would agree to work for 1 hour in that building in which we force these kids to spend their entire teenage lives. And Mariah wanted to go to college. But she said to me, last year I was told I had to take a sewing class. And this year I'm told that I have to take hairdressing. Hairdressing. So I said to her, what would you rather take? And she said, I wanted to take an AP course in English. Suddenly she began to cry in front of me. She said, I didn't need to take a sewing class. I already know how to sew because my mother is a seamstress in a sewing factory. I hoped for something more. And there was a marvelous boy in that class, a young guy, another Latino student, who had this smoldering look of cynical intelligence in his eyes. He reminded me of the look in the eyes of Malcolm X. And he suddenly looks at her when she starts to cry, and he says, "Listen to me. The owners of the sewing factories need workers, don't they?" And she says, "Well, I guess they do." And he says, "They're not going to be their own kids, are they? They're not going to hire their own children for those jobs." And one student says, another student says, "Why not?" And Mariah softly says, "So they can grow beyond themselves, but we remain the same." And, boy, no political philosopher could have put it better. That wonderful student stayed with me the whole time I was there. I don't know why, but kids get attached to me, and I love it when they do. And sometimes later I can help them. I'll certainly help her when she applies to college, because she will go to college, but she's going to be damaged by all the time they're stealing from her education. She probably will never get into a first-rate university. She might have to, you know, she's lucky she'll get into some college. But this is a terrible thing to do to kids. It's like the cognitive decapitation of potential. It's like cutting off their heads. It's like crippling their intellects. Giving her sewing and hairdressing while white kids in Beverly Hills are taking calculus and AP history and advanced Asian studies and French, things that look terrific on their college applications. And this goes on and on and on in the United States. Try giving hairdressing classes and sewing classes to the teenage girls in the white suburb where most of our, in Washington, where most of our congressmen live. They'd fire the principal overnight. This is an example of what I call an apartheid curriculum for children this nation doesn't value. And I'll tell you, it's easier to do it to them if we keep them out of sight. And that's what segregation makes possible.
And if segregation is a service to the conscience of America, then this book, Jonathan Kozol's latest book, is a very welcome and very needed, urgently needed disservice. This is The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. We're speaking with the author, Jonathan Kozol. We're coming up on the end of the hour, and I want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about it. There's a couple of dimensions, I think, even if we can just touch on these. The one is, in your earlier books, like Savage Inequalities, you've talked about the structural features of our society. In particular, I remember vividly your description of how property taxes being the basis for funding our schools meant that the higher property taxes of the suburbs meant that these students from the suburbs would have fine schools with excellent facilities, and the property taxes of the inner cities left those students with much lesser facilities for learning. What are the structural features of our society today that are a barrier to fighting against segregation? And then let's move on to the question of where is some reason for hope? What are the most promising avenues towards changing this situation in our country?
Okay, well, I'll reverse it if you don't mind, because, I mean, there is one thing that fills me with hope everywhere I go, and that is the fact that there are so many genuinely terrific, utterly unselfish teachers working in almost every urban district that I visit. The young teachers that I see coming into these schools are more idealistic, more deeply grounded in a sense of moral justice than any of the teachers that I knew 40 years ago when I was starting out, at least most of them. And that's why this book is written very much from the vantage point of teachers. I don't bully teachers the way the politicians do so frequently. The president says that, you know, teachers who don't like his testing agenda are must be mediocre teachers who have low expectations. The irony that he would dare to say that of these teachers who could teach. I'm talking about teachers who have gone to terrific universities who could teach anywhere they want. They go into these inner city schools precisely because they have the highest possible expectations. And the president has the sheer chutzpah to, that's a New York word, to say if the test scores aren't good, the teachers are guilty of what he calls soft bigotry. What a turnaround coming from a president who has never lifted a finger to speak of the rapid resegregation of our schools and hasn't done a thing to equalize school finance. You ask me what makes me optimistic. It's the number of remarkable teachers that I meet, not just the young ones either. There are these terrific veteran teachers. A lot of them are older African-American women who have known me for years, or at least seems like we've known each other. And these are rock-solid, wonderful human beings. So that's one reason everywhere I go, like in Portland, I make sure that I spend time with teachers. But there's only one ultimate structural solution to the inequalities that we see between school districts in America, and that is to abolish the entire present system of school finance, get rid of the local property tax, get rid of these state formulas by which states pretend to equalize funding between rich and poor districts, which they never do. All children in America ought to be funded to an equally high level of education out of the real wealth of our nation. And that means the money for every child's education in this country should be guaranteed by the federal government. At present, there is in the United States Constitution no entitlement to equal education. So one of the things I propose in this book is that we need a constitutional amendment to make that possible, to create a high level of equal education as a federal responsibility. Because kids don't go to school in order to learn to be, you know, citizens of Omaha, Nebraska, or Portland, Oregon. They don't pledge a flag of allegiance to North Dakota. They go to school to learn to be Americans. And if we expect them to grow up to be loyal Americans and to honor that pledge to the flag, then we damn well ought to treat every one of them as equally valuable Americans when they're 6 and 8 and 10 years old. So that's one of the major proposals of this book. But the other point I'd like to make is that we're not going to get rid of segregation in this country by simply, you know, having more token interracial celebrations. Segregated cities love to do that. I've been invited to cities where they say, I say, what is this event I'm speaking at? And they say, this is Interracial Day. once a year. Those are feel-good events, but they don't change a thing. They don't change anything. After you know, everybody gets together and feels good and sings We Shall Overcome, the rich go back to their accustomed lily-white privilege, and the poor go back to their absolute social and residential isolation. We are never going to change this unless there's a tremendous upsurge of political mobilization among ordinary people in this country. I mean another movement, another struggle, at least of the magnitude of the civil rights struggles of the 1960s. But it will be a different kind of struggle. You can't rerun history. But a struggle that has that kind of passion. And especially essential to that struggle will be young people, because a lot of their parents have abandoned the struggle. But the young people read history, and I'm talking about, and I'm not just talking about, you know, the passionate young black and Latino kids I meet, like those wonderful kids I met in Los Angeles, but white kids who have gone to the best high schools. They know that the one enduring cancer on the body of American democracy is apartheid. It was our sin from the beginning in the days of slavery. It is still our sin. It is not just something that's unfortunate. That's a term they'd use in a boring think tank. It's worse than that. It is a theological and moral evil. It's an abomination. And we need young people, and young teachers especially, who have the guts to take risks with their own careers, with their own personal comfort, and take the big risk of offending plenty of their privileged neighbors by waging an all-out battle against residential segregation in the suburbs, against urban segregation of our schools in the cities. And they also ought to be fighting like hell to make sure that every affluent suburban school district in America, even if it's in a lily white neighborhood, opens its doors to black kids and Latino kids from the city who want to go to those schools.
Jonathan Kozol, thank you for spending this much time with us.
I'm delighted. This is one of my favorite stations. We don't have one like that in Boston. You're lucky.
I think we are very lucky to have KBOO Community Radio here. And you've been listening to a KBOO Public Affairs special feature. I'm William Seaman. Thank you for listening.